podcast is brought to you by Epicor Profit 21 ERP, purpose built for distributors. In sports, the best teams don't chase the scoreboard. They set the pace. And in distribution, pace matters. 60% of the top distributors run on Profit 21 because it delivers real-time inventory visibility, smarter purchasing, and connected operations from sales to fulfillment. Don't play catch-up. Set the pace with Epicor Profit 21 ERP. Visit epicor.com/win.
Deceit. Telling the truth is a revolutionary act. It's the David Knight Show.
As the clock strikes 13, it's Friday, the 27th of February, year of our Lord, 2026. Well, today we're going to have a couple of interviews I think you're going to find really informative. We have one person who's going to share his cancer story. He is now 52 years past the point they said he'd be dead. I think you're going to find it very enlightening, very hopeful. As a matter of fact, he's got an acronym for what he does, HOPE, helping other people escape. Escape the kind of medieval treatment that we have in the cancer community that's here. But we're also going to be talking about another thing that a lot of people dismiss as medieval. I want to finish up what I began yesterday in terms of talking about the satanic singularity that we see coming towards us. And of course, it's all the different aspects of the Epstein pedophile satanic ritual child abuse that's there, the pharmakia, the sorcery, the push towards using these hallucinogenic drugs that have always been throughout millennia have been used as a way to contact the occult, and of course, the way the CIA has used this, and Artichoke, and MK Ultra, and many other things. There's all these different threads seem to be coming together, and the Trump administration seems to be ready to do this through so-called disclosure. Well, let's begin with that. I was talking about this yesterday, and I ran out of time, and there's a lot more that I really wanted to say. Didn't get a chance to cover it. And I had just started talking about DMT, which, in case you don't know what that is, it's something that has been used for a very long time in the Amazon, and they have used it for psychedelic rituals as part of religions there. And this is something that we have seen used for thousands of years. Of course, the Bible refers to that as pharmakia, translated as sorcery. I used to refer to that all the time as big pharma, pharmakia, because talked about how the biggest men on earth in terms of money and importance and things like that would not repent of their murders and other things. And I think it also ties into that. But this is quite literally what was being talked about in the Bible. And now it is being, there's an attempt to mainstream it. It's an attempt that is coming multiple places from government officials and politicians. It's not just the CIA using it for their own occultic programs, but these are politicians that are using it now. And just to give you an idea of DMT, they're now pushing it as a promising therapy for depression. And you've got some pharmaceutical companies that are getting on board to make a lot of money out of it. If you look it up, you will find a lot of people talking about mechanical elves and other beings that they come in contact with when they take DMT. And I know someone who told me that he took it, and he said it's the scariest thing he ever had happen to him in his life, and he gets really wide-eyed when he starts to talk about it. There are common descriptions of what people come across. Here's an example of this, and this is a book that was written by somebody who actually likes it and is pushing it. There's a lot of people who are very excited about it. They even call themselves, some of them, psychonauts, and saying that they're like astronauts who are traveling but into a different dimension. And they want to share their experiences with these beings that they come in contact with. And so here's this this one book, The Illustrated Field Guide to DMT Entities, Machine Elves, Tricksters, Teachers, and Other Interdimensional Beings. And there's a quote from who's an author of another book that's called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. Richard Strassman, who's the author of that, is an MD. He said, the psychedelic version of fantastic beasts and where to find them. We know where to find them, and now we know what to expect. New species will be discovered. Others may die out, but this compendium of DMT beings provides a most exhaustive snapshot of our day's varieties. Another one, another review from the author of another book about the same type of thing, The Visionary, The Mysterious Origins of Human Consciousness. He writes, the DMT experience is fundamentally about exploring and traveling to unknown or forgotten realms. Realms that are unutterably strange and yet strangely familiar. These realms are inhabited by intelligent beings with much to teach. Like any challenging and perhaps even perilous journey, it's important to prepare and to be willing to learn from the experiences and the hard-won knowledge of others. Another review. DMT is fascinating for many reasons, but not the least because it seems to provide ready access to hyperdimensional realm populated by a vast collection of non-human, intelligent, apparently independent entities. Often these entities seem to have a message or many messages for our species or an individual psychonaut that are weighted with portent. They definitely seem to have a classification system and characteristics that are familiar to many psychedelic voyagers. And then one more I'll give you here. The demonic, from the demonic to the divine, this is the most beautiful, comprehensive, and I dare say indispensable guide to the resident fauna of the DMT realm. You won't want to venture into the hyperdimensional hinterlands without this field guide in your back pocket. I imagine when somebody's on a trip of this kind of stuff, you're not going to be pulling out a book to read it. This guy is the author of Alien Information Theory and Reality Switch Technologies, the best bestiary or hyperspace denizens so far. So again, there is a whole culture that has come up around this. And this is ancient. It's been happening for thousands of years. And yet, in our lifetime, since World War II, we've had this fable of UFOs that has taken place. That is the fable, folks. And yet, they want to present that as a scientific reality. That is what is before us. And we need to get a handle on the reference points. This is one of, you know, generally I would say I see eye to eye pretty much on politics with David Icke, but this is where we part ways, because what he does is he looks at it in the same way that Arthur C. Clarke did in terms of the film that I talked about yesterday, Childhood's End, where he posits in his science fiction, he has a group of aliens actually coming from a planet of fire. And they look exactly like all the medieval depictions of Satan or demons, complete with the Baphomet horns and the cloved hooves and all the rest of the stuff and red skin and all the rest of that. And so what he's doing is he's saying, well, it was space aliens all along. You just got it wrong, thinking that it was demons, right? And David Icke says the same thing as well. He says, you got all these religions and cultures. They talk about djinns. They talk about demons and all the rest of the stuff. But it's really just space aliens. I say they flipped the labels. They flipped the switch. They have done this because they can't posit the idea of there being a God. And so this is an evolutionary inversion of reality. And that's what we need to come to grips with. All of these different streams are coming together. The ritualized drugs that play tricks with your mind and perhaps do take you to another realm. Who knows what's happening? There was a guy that was working on a documentary that I met at an event that I was speaking at, and they had gone to Burning Man, and what they said they saw there and were told that they had all these Silicon Valley big tech executives, the multi-billionaires. They were all in a tent, a bunch of them in a tent, and they were doing DMT, and they were getting technology from these mechanical elves that they would then use. Now, I don't know if that was true or not, but he said these people thought it was happening. And so when you look at this and what is behind it, whether you're talking about the technocracy and their idea of a singularity, which again is a counterfeit repetition of the lies of the Garden of Eden, when you look at these different threads, the ancient ritualized drugs that would get people in contact with these spirits, as well as the ritualized child abuse, All of it is connected to these intelligence agencies and to Jeffrey Epstein and people of that ilk. And so all these different threads are coming together. And I think when you look at how they're going to push this out and to what end this is going to be, I think they're ready to do it. Because we had, as I pointed out yesterday, we had Barack Obama just kind of casually, oh, yeah, they're real, you know, and let that sit there for about a day. And then he came back from it. The next day, Laura Trump, I don't know if it was the next day, but it was soon after that, Laura Trump on Fox News was talking about it, and I reported this, and she said, yeah, my father-in-law has got the letter written. It's just a question of timing. And so we can look at this from a purely political standpoint and say, yeah, he wants to have something that's going to distract people, and certainly there will be an advantage to him for that. But he is also selling this as well. He was then asked a question by Peter Doocy of Fox News on Air Force One about what Obama had said, and this is what Trump said.
Barack Obama said that aliens are real. Have you seen any evidence of non-human visitors to Earth?
Well, he gave classified information. He's not supposed to be doing that.
You know? So aliens are real?
Well, I don't know if they're real or not. I can tell you he gave classified information. He's not supposed to be doing that.
Well,
he made a big mistake. He took it out of classified information. No, I don't have an opinion on it. I never talk about it. A lot of people do. A lot of people believe it. Do you believe it, Peter?
The president can declassify anything that he wants to.
Well,
so
maybe
if you want to make an announcement.
I may get him out of trouble by declassifying.
We know illegal aliens.
Yeah, maybe he will declassify it, right? And like Laura Trump said, he's already got the letter written. It's just a matter of when he wants to drop that. And, of course, then they asked Pete Hegseth, because this is kind of under the Department of Defense, and here's what Pete Hegseth had to say.
3 days ago, President Trump directed you to begin the process of identifying and releasing the UFO and UAP files. I mean, did you ever think that you could be the Secretary of War in charge of potentially declassifying extraterrestrial life to the American people?
I did not have that on my bingo card at all.
And are you prepared to do that now?
Of course. I mean, we've got our people working on it right now. I don't want to oversell how much time it will take, right? We're digging in. We're going to be in full compliance with that executive order, eager to provide that for the president. So there'll be more coming on that as far as the process of what we'll do.
And what sort of time frame? Do you have any sense for how long this is going to take?
I don't have a time frame for you yet, but stand by. We'll get it for you.
And do you give us any latest on what's happening?
What?
Do you think aliens exist?
We'll see. I get to do the review and find out along with you.
Well, there are definitely other beings, and of course, every Christian knows that we're not the only intelligent life. We know that God is there. We know that there's angels and demons, and we also know that all this stuff that they like to present as hidden knowledge is simply the occult. And the American government has been trading in the occult and working in the occult for a very, very long time, going back to the CIA in the mid-20th century, Project Artichoke. It was about 70 years ago, the CIA discussed hiding mind control drugs in vaccines. This is from Children's Health Defense. The program, Project Artichoke, ran from 1951 to 1956. So in the 1950s, the CIA brainstormed ways to secretly perform mind control on humans, including concealing drugs in vaccines and widely consumed food products, a newly unearthed CIA document revealed. The Daily Mail first reported the story on Monday. The 7-page document, Special Research for Artichoke, it described a series of ideas for how to develop chemicals designed to alter human behavior via drugs. The proposals contained in the document were part of the CIA's top secret Project Artichoke, which ran from 51 to 56. According to the Daily Mail, it included administering drugs in secret as part of a long-range approach to subjects. Again, we know they did this with LSD, and there was a famous scientist who was taken out with that. And so they had no qualms whatsoever giving things to people surreptitiously and without informed consent. The study
and
should include
also the whole practice of putting products in food that's consumed that has a psychedelic effect. Isn't that essentially fluoride in the water supply, one thing?
Yeah, you could put that in that category as well. Yeah, they definitely want to control our minds in order to dumb them down, not to open them up to other beings. But all of these things are part of it. When you look at the CIA, how evil they have been, they have, this didn't start with Jeffrey Epstein. They were doing this a long time before that. They were setting up honeypot traps to blackmail people with sexual stuff and in terms of mind control drugs and all the rest of this, pedophile rings, all of this. And this truly is a convergence of a lot of these different evil streams that have been out there. They're all related to each other. When you look at what is happening, you know, we've been sold a mythology through Hollywood for quite some time about UFOs to try to put it into a scientific approach, a scientific and mathematical approach. And what it is a rebranding of an ancient truth, because the ancient truth has to be kept from us, right? As I talked about yesterday, there was one scientist who is a secularist and atheist. He did an investigation of it, and he said, well, they're not behaving as if they were aliens from another planet. They're tricksters, and they're deceptive, and there's religious aspects of it as well. But again, going back to the CIA, the study should include chemicals, they said, or drugs that can effectively be concealed in common items such as food, water, Coca-Cola, beer, liquor, cigarettes, etc. This type of drug should be capable of use in standard medical treatments like vaccinations, shots, etc. And so they experimented on people as part of Project Artichoke. They included also mushrooms in this that produce a certain type of intoxication, mental derangement. And, of course, LSD was a synthetic that was created by them, popularized by them. And then as they're pushing these drugs like LSD and Ken Kesey and his merry band of pranksters, they then said, well, that's so dangerous, we need to have drug prohibition. That was the beginning of the drug war. And, of course, who is pushing the drugs the most? It's the CIA. Again, this is all a convergence of all these different elements coming together. So I think disclosure will be something that they can use as a deceptive method to distract people from what is really happening, as well as the other things that they wish to do. According to Ben Tapper, a Nebraska chiropractor who was included in the Disinformation Dozen in 2021 for questioning vaccine safety, he said, a disturbing reality that government agencies have historically explored ways to manipulate human behavior through chemical and biological means, including concepts involving food and medical interventions. This is not speculation, it's not conspiracy, and it should deeply concern every American who values bodily autonomy and informed consent. So again, Project Artichoke grew into and became MK Ultra, which has been exposed before. But Naomi Wolf, who has written about Pfizer and Pfizer's crimes against humanity, that's the name of her book, the documents further confirm a long history of intelligence agencies' research targeting human thought and behavior. As I've said for the longest time, we make a big mistake when we don't understand how powerful their technology is and that there are no limits on what they are morally capable of either. Certainly, when we look at the history of the CIA, it comes up over and over again. She said, researchers have long suspected the Church Committee's revelation that the CIA's notorious MK-Ultra mind control experiments, mostly using LSD, had the effect of obscuring the agency's much larger Project Artichoke. And so this is all, when you look at the disclosure talk that is coming out there, just understand that you need to have some discernment, you need to have a frame of reference. Are you going to base this on some papers from the Pentagon and from the CIA, people who work for them? Is that going to be your frame of reference for the truth? Or are you going to rest it on the scriptures, on the Bible? That's the key for you to get through this, to understand what is true and where you stand on this. Because a lot of these things are coming through. So they point out last year, a pharmaceutical research and development executive, we're talking about this, and of course, Sasha Latapova, I'm sure you know of her, and Debbie Lerman, released the COVID dossier, presenting evidence that the military-industrial coordination of the COVID response was not a public health event, but a global operation, coordinated through public-private intelligence and military alliances, involving laws designed for chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapon attacks. And, of course, it was also a PSYOP. And we know that they did, these are the germ games that they practiced for 20 years, the first one being Dark Winter, and that was an alliance of these public health agencies, the corporations, as well as the intelligence agencies. And they practiced and rehearsed this stuff for 20 years before they unleashed it on us. The entire thing was a psyop. And of course, Yale, the only studies that were really done in terms of the COVID stuff, they didn't do any studies to determine the safety or the efficacy of any vaccines or any of the rest of that stuff. The studies that they did were how they were going to manipulate people and trick people into taking these vaccines when there wasn't going to be any safety or efficacy that was determined with any of this. They would skip all the testing except for the psychological operation. That was very heavily tested. Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to come back, and I've got the interview with the cancer survivor over half a century, and he's doing great. He's probably in better health than I am. And what he had to say about what worked for him and what continued to work for him. And I think it's very important. I just saw an article from retired Senator Ben Sasse. He has terminal cancer. He's got tumors all over his body, and he says he's basically, there's nothing else that can be done. He's basically given up. But he did have an interesting quote. He said, I remember when Tim Keller died, Tim Keller, a Christian pastor and teacher, he said Tim Keller, when he had same type of cancer that Ben Sasse had, he said, there's a lot of things that I regret, but he says, one thing that I would not give up is I would never want to go back to the prayer life that I had before I had cancer. And so Ben Sasse said, I didn't understand that at the time, but I understand it now. Well, that is an important thing, but it's also important for us to know that there are things out there that apparently for some people, certainly at least for our guest, worked far better than any of the standard cancer treatments. And then after his interview, we're going to have an interview with someone who is going to talk about how real estate is being changed, the buying and selling of real estate, how technology is impinging on that. You know, everything is being rapidly changed by technology, and that's one of the things. And he has an international brokerage firm, and he's going to talk a little bit about what the real estate picture looks like internationally. Curiously enough, he's based out of Venezuela, and he finds these depressed areas, you know, like somebody might go into Detroit and look for a bargain there and hope that it's going to turn around. He thinks that Venezuela is at rock bottom and it's going to turn around, so he thinks it's a big business opportunity. But he also helps people, a lot of them maybe here because they come from another country, and they're thinking as they retire they're going to go back to their home country. It could be Ireland, it could be Greece, it could be Mexico or whatever. And a lot of people looking to save money as they retire. So he said he's got a business that helps people do that. So I think you'll find that interesting as well. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with the cancer survivor.
Listening to the David Knight Show.
Well, joining us now is Rick Hill. He's an ambassador for Oasis of Hope Hospital. He's also, most importantly, a cancer survivor, and he's written about that. He had cancer 52 years ago, and he found something that's very effective. So we want to find out a little bit about his story, because We're seeing an uptick in cancer, not only that, but in turbo cancer. We've got just this last week or so, we now have the Trump administration pushing for glyphosate, compelling its production, and offering legal immunity for that. So what can we do as individuals to protect ourselves from cancer? So we wanted to talk to Rick Hill about that. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Well, you're welcome. Looking forward to this, and you're quite right. You know, most of what has happened in this administration has been good, but man, he's got to backtrack on this because we MAGA supporters, or me, I should say, don't like this, and I'm going to be vocal about it. Yeah, glyphosate is not good for us.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave him $1 million toward his campaign last year. And I think that's caving in. No, yeah.
That seems to be the magic number.
Yeah.
$1 million.
I'm telling you.
They always seem to be able to get at least 1,000 times return on their investment. You just give somebody thousands of dollars, you get millions or billions of dollars. You know, in this particular case, they got a lot more than millions of dollars. But anyway, yeah, let's talk a little bit about your story. And then we'll talk about the pushback from the cancer industry as to what you're saying. And I think we have seen all that. This is an opportunity, I think, that they handed us because people have been trying to talk about alternative medicine and say, why can't we try this or try that? We saw that all shut down during the pandemic. They said, well, here's this terrible pandemic. It's the worst thing we've ever seen in history. And yet we're not going to let you try anything. You're going to sit there locked down until we've got our our solution is delivered to you. And then we'll compel you to take that. And I think that woke a lot of people up. I mean, if that doesn't wake you up, what will, right?
Yeah, that was a frightening time.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, golly, I didn't survive the Mayo Clinic and then my flight to Tijuana to be taken out by a vaccine.
Yeah.
And I didn't get it. I refused it.
Good.
And, you know, I just at Thanksgiving, there are things we didn't talk about with our family.
That's right.
And that was one of them. Yeah.
Well, a lot of people were taken in by it. A lot of people, unfortunately, have been taken out by it. But let's talk about cancer. And tell us your story. You were diagnosed in 1974. What kind of cancer did you have?
The technical term, Travis, is embryonal cell carcinoma. And that is a germ cancer, meaning I probably had it from birth.
Hmm.
And I was 24 when I was diagnosed, and they did 8.5 hours of exploratory surgery. Remember?
Wow.
They didn't have scans way back then.
Wow.
And so they operated up here in my clavicle and found in the lymphatic system a cancer. And the lymphatic system is like a super highway. Once you get it in there, man, especially if it's high grade embryonal cell carcinoma, that's like stage 4.
Mm.
And in the system like that, it runs like a racehorse. And they operated on my feet. They found it head to toe.
Wow.
Sewed me back up and said, invite your family in. You are in trouble.
Wow.
So my family flew into town and I was scheduled to have chemo.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where the story really gets interesting. Imagine a guy down to 120 pounds on morphine, scheduled for chemotherapy on Monday. It's now Friday. And I get a letter in the mail. I open it, says, Dear Rick, if you want to live, you're going to have to leave the Mayo Clinic.
Wow.
So I knew this guy. He's a Baptist pastor. And I called him up and I said, you know, whatever you're smoking, send me some. Because, you know, I'm about a week away from meeting our creator. And he said, well, I know that. That's why I wrote you. I said, well, John, what are you, not John Richardson. His name is John Ballantyne. I said, John, what are you thinking? Why would I leave the Mayo Clinic? It's a citadel of modern medicine. He said, I agree with that, but I don't think it's medicine you need. And I said, well, what do you think I need? He said, are you sitting down? The story was so bizarre. He said, you're going to have to leave and go to Tijuana. And there they're going to take a derivative of the apricot fruit and inject it in your veins. Mm. I said, that's the story you want me to give my family that have flown in to say goodbye, that I'm leaving the Mayo Clinic. I've got good insurance and I'm going to go to TJ for apricot. And he said, I know it doesn't sound good, does it? I said, no. And I said, look, John, I'm not going to argue with you. I have an appointment with my chemotherapist in about an hour. I'm going to drive over there and I'm going to tell him what you told me. Mm-hmm. I'm telling on you. And he said, good luck with that, pal. So I did. I got my car. I drove over there, sat down, told him the story I just told your viewers. And I thought I was going to learn new swear words. I thought this chemotherapist was, you little pipsqueak, you know, da, 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 da. And instead, he folded his arms, sat back in his chair, and he says to me, you know, Rick, it is warm in Tijuana this time of year. And I thought, did I hear what I just heard? And, you know, he's not going to jeopardize his 300K job a year.
Oh, yeah.
And I stood up and I said, message delivered. I appreciate your honesty. Mm-hmm. And I walked to the door, put my hand on the handle, turned and said, I probably will never see you again. Mm. And he smiled and I left. Wow. 2 days later, I'm in TJ. And that was like going down the rabbit hole. I mean, I grew up a Detroit greaser. You know what a greaser is? Like Fonzie.
Oh, yeah.
That is what I look like in 1974. I'm a little messed up there, but that's after 10 hours of being under, you know, surgery. Mm-hmm. And I did, if there was a health food store in Detroit, I'd never been to it and didn't know where it was. And I wouldn't have. Yeah, I mean, my mother grew up in Alabama. I grew up on soul food, which is fried pork, mm-hmm. country gravy on everything, you know, all the sweets you could eat. And we just weren't that family. We weren't. And here I am in a health food store now in San Diego trying to find something I can eat because they told me no more bad food, no more sugar. And I felt like there's Ravi Shankar music playing in the background. I'm the only one in the store wearing underwear. I mean, this is like stone ground heaven for these people. And I'm thinking, I don't blend.
Yeah.
And you know what? I want to make a point here. Your viewers don't have to blend for this to work.
Yeah.
They have to be willing to alter their life.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have to be, you know, a 1970s, what I would, and I'm not trying to offend anybody, mm-hmm. hippie
yeah.
to make this work. Mm-hmm. I'm a greaser. I'm wearing a long leather jacket. You know, and I thought, I just don't blend. But when I met Dr. Contreras Sr.,
uh-huh.
he said to me a very important statement. He said, Rick, this is participatory medicine.
Hmm.
If you don't help us, we will fail and you will die. You're a sick puppy.
Wow.
And I need your help. I said, well, what do you want me to do, doc? He said, everything we ask you to do, I want you to be willing to do it. And I just had no idea what that entailed. First day I'm in there, they come in and they give me the Laetril, you know, shots right here in the arm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that vitamin B17, amygdalin, a derivative of the apricot,
mm-hmm.
6 grams, you know, mm-hmm. that's a big shot.
Mm-hmm.
And then they gave me a whole bunch of pancreatic enzymes. Mm. Nothing like that had ever been in this body,
mm-hmm.
Either one. And then she comes in carrying a bag and the nurse is trying to be cheery. And she says, today we are going to start your detox program. I said, great. What's a detox? And she says, well, have you ever changed the water in the radiator of your car? I said, well, of course. She says, how'd you do it? I said, well, you know, you undo the deals, you get the garden hose, and then when it runs clear, you take the hose out, cap it up, lay rubber out of the parking lot. I had a 57 Ford, slick tires, Hurst floor shift, handling life. Okay. I look at her and I say, that thing you're carrying, where does that hose go? And she says, well, and for your listeners that don't know what a colonic is, picture yourself water skiing really fast and then just sit down. Okay. That's kind of what a colonic is. And I didn't tell any of my friends about this. I didn't even tell my family what I was doing. But here's the thing. I was only there 3 weeks. And after 3 weeks, my color came back.
Wow.
My appetite came back. I wasn't cured. I don't think anybody's cured. You can bring that stuff back in a heartbeat if you go back to doing what you were doing before you got sick.
Yeah.
And 3 weeks, I'm out of there.
Wow.
And a lady that I know on my Facebook site was there when I was there. Glioblastoma, brain cancer, spread to her spine, couldn't walk. Mm. 3 weeks later, Travis, mm-hmm. both of us walked out of that clinic.
Wow. Wow.
And she contacts, I saw her 2 days ago on my Facebook site, living in Key West. 20 or 30 grandkids, too much sun. I'm not a one-off deal.
Yeah.
Not a one-off deal.
Wow.
There are hundreds of thousands of us out there, but I'm one of the few vocal ones mm-hmm. because our government, and this is kind of what I want to focus on if you're agreeable.
Oh, yeah.
Our government drove it underground. In fact, the book that I wrote, Too Young to Die, I mean, I had to be careful where I sold that. I've got a little thing here that when I would go to a town and speak, that town would put a little thing in the newspaper saying I was coming. And then after I had spoken, they put another article in the paper saying, here's what he said. The American Cancer Society used to put an alternate position right across from my article that said, as for the testimony offered, it may be that he never had cancer in the first place.
Yeah, I saw that.
They denied it. So after about the third article, I clipped them, sent them to the Mayo Clinic, and said, you have misdiagnosed me. The American Cancer Society says this, that I never had it in the first place. So what did you do that surgery for? I'm getting an attorney. I got this letter back overnight from the Mayo Clinic in regard to your question that people have asked, questioning as to whether or not you actually did have cancer in the first place. You are entirely right that you had stage 3 high grade embryonal cell carcinoma and that chemotherapy was mandatory when I up and left.
Wow. Well,
so,
and the letter that you sent me was from the doctor that diagnosed it. He said, I'm glad that you're feeling well. But he goes, you know, we did this. We found the tumor. He talked about all the different aspects. So what were the symptoms that you had with that cancer?
Well, I had a tumor. It was in the groin. So I didn't do a lot of horseback riding back mm-hmm. then. And then I started not feeling well, achy, bad mood, and I was a parochial school principal at the time. Mm. I had to go to seminary to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, golly, I work for God. What is this about? What do you mean terminal? Why would you use that term with me? And it's discouraging. That's what I want people yeah. to know, that if they're dealing with this and they're discouraged, I'm on your team.
Oh, yeah.
Because I know what it is to believe that I may not have any hope left mm-hmm. In this life.
Mm-hmm.
And I define hope as that my calling now is helping other people escape. H-O-P-E. Because I think for most people, not everybody, but for most people, if the disease didn't kill them, the chemo will.
Yeah, yeah,
I agree. If the disease didn't kill them, the radiation will.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking you in the eye, Travis, and I'm saying, I took massive amounts of amygdalin and the pancreatic enzymes and everything else. I never even got a headache. Mm. My hair didn't fall out. Now today is falling out, but I'm 74 years old. Okay. Let's talk.
Yeah.
And, but not then. I didn't have a fever. I didn't throw up. I wasn't running to the bathroom. People would say,
I'm sympathetic with that. My father died from chemotherapy. The very first time they gave him the chemotherapy, he went into a coma and he never came out of it. So, you know, the stuff that they give people, I was open to this from the very beginning. But like I said, I think we've got an opening because of what people saw 5 years ago. And the fact that there was obviously a different agenda. One of the articles that you clipped and sent to me, it was a rebuttal, part of the rebuttal from the American Cancer Society. And they said, well, we just don't feel that this has any benefit. And I went, whoa, wait a minute. You don't feel that it has, there's nothing scientific or medical about this. You just don't feel that it has any benefit. And you keep on reading and it says, well, to date, there haven't been any test results to show its effectiveness. It's like, well, then there haven't been any test results to show that it's not effective either, right? You haven't tested it. You just, this is not about medicine or science. It's about business, I think.
Deny. Because, Travis, nobody kicks a dead dog. Mm-hmm. And nobody's throwing doctors in jail and terminating their license like they did John Richardson's father.
Huh? Yeah, yeah.
If they're prescribing ivermectin or Fenbin or mistletoe or these other things that are out there, why? Because they don't work as well. They work. They help.
Yeah.
But they don't work as well as this does.
Yeah. That's
right. This was developed in 1902.
Wow.
By a Dr. John Beard in the book World Without Cancer, Chapter 5.
Mm-hmm.
This guy had a whole bunch of stage 4 cancer people, gave them these pancreatic enzymes, chymotrypsin and trypsin, and they got well. And he published the results. They came after him. So nobody kicks a dead dog. And even today, I went in to a very popular hospital chain just for my annual checkup. I'm not against medicine. I'm not against all doctors and everything. But
let the buyer beware. That's the whole thing. We should be skeptical about it, just not blindly trust this stuff. And that's what a lot of people do. Yeah.
And this, I had to get another doctor because he found out that I went to Tijuana.
Really? He didn't want to teach you.
And he said, yeah, some people think if they eat apricots, they're going to get well. And I said, Doc, I did that. And he looked at his file and he didn't have anything in there. And he said, we're done here. And he got up, left the office and slammed the door.
Wow.
51 years later, he's slamming the door in my face. I'm thinking, these people hold on to grievances. You think you go, well, let's let bygones be bygones. You look pretty good now. Nope.
Yeah, they're not interested in the actual results there. They've got their paradigm and their business that they want to push forward, and that's the key thing. Well, I certainly know what that is like, and of course my audience knows that as well. I've been banned on PayPal and Venmo and YouTube and Facebook and on and on and on. Because I'm not going to be quiet about it, and I appreciate you persisting in this as well. Because it's very important when you get something like this, and you have to look at why these people are so hell-bent, literally hell-bent, on trying to suppress this information that could help people, and to push something on them that's going to harm them because they have some benefit somehow out of this. That is the amazing thing. But I really like your acronym of HOPE, helping other people escape. That's really the key thing, I think.
Well, and I'd like to give your viewers a free book with no credit card, nobody calls, but if they will log on to myworldwithoutcancer.com, I will send them a 300-page book, which has, in Chapter 5, this Dr. Beard's research. So that they can go, well, and you know, I heard this weird story today on this program, but the guy sent me a free book. I read it, and it seems credible to me. And this is from 1902.
Wow.
All these years they've hidden this.
Wow.
And I just think that's criminal. Just mm-hmm. criminal. How come I couldn't use my insurance to get this treatment?
Yeah.
Why did I have to leave the country to do it?
That's right. And why is it that doctors can't talk to patients about different alternatives? Why do I have to have politicians that are going to set in judgment what I'm allowed to use for my own health? That makes absolutely no sense. But that's where we are in this country, unfortunately.
So they can get that free book, and then if they want my book for free, they can go on to b17works.com, and there's a little questionnaire to fill out. And if they want to talk to me, I'll give them a call back, or I'll send them an email, but I'll also send them a PDF copy of my book, Too Young to Die. Now, I'm not a scholar. I'm not a doctor, but it's a story of hope.
Well, you know, I've talked to John Richards.
And I give you the gory details.
Yes, I've talked to John Richards several times, and I told him, I said, I don't discount anecdotal stories. I think they're very important. Because when you look at these studies that are orchestrated, I report on this over and over again, how you got three different pharmaceutical companies. They've all got a drug that they want to use to sell you to treat a particular condition. And they all do their own studies. And guess what? The people that they hire to do the studies, if brand A hires the person to do the test, guess which brand is the best one? Brand A. And if brand B hires somebody else, it's going to be brand B is going to be the best one. And so I don't really have a lot of faith in a lot of these studies, because if you look at them, a lot of them have a conflict of interest in terms of who's paying for them. Whenas you look at somebody's particular anecdotal story like yours, your interest is just in trying to help other people and tell them where you found some help. And that's the key thing.
Well, nobody sent me $1 million last year.
That's right.
Pain, you know, and I just, I'm not for sale. And I've done without some things in order to do this, but I look at it this way. This Baptist pastor, right? 51 years ago, stuck his nose in my business and said, Rick, you're going to die if you keep doing what you're doing. And today I'm 74, 75 now. And I don't have the problems that other people have. I just don't.
That's great.
I don't. Yeah. I see people in grocery stores. They're my age.
Yeah.
Hanging on the handle to get out of the store.
Wow.
Nothing but sugar in their cart.
Yeah.
And they're on 8 or 9 prescriptions.
That's the other thing. Yeah. That's the other thing. They give you a prescription for one thing. And then that may actually exacerbate that condition, but then it creates some other side issues. And so you start taking some drugs for these other side issues. And now what's the interaction with all these drugs? Nobody tests that at all.
Metformin is a gateway. And unfortunately in our society, about 2/3 of the people you'll ever walk by are on metformin and glipizide and all these other things because somebody convinced them that sugar's okay in modest amounts, as long as it's in fruit, modest amounts, it is okay. But a Coca-Cola, you know, 9 tablespoons of sugar in that puppy, and then they go into the 7-Eleven and get a big gulp. A little one's not enough.
Yeah.
I want to die quickly. So big gulp. What a species we are.
Yeah, it really is amazing too when you go back and look at pictures of just the general population in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and so, and how thin everybody was, and how heavy everybody is today. It's amazing for me to go back and look. I tried to go back to the high school I attended and see what was happening to it, because there was a controversy about the mascot there. It was Chiefs, and they don't allow that anymore, right? And so I go back and look, and the band that was there and the majorettes and cheerleaders and stuff, it's like, how did everybody get so fat? It's amazing.
Look terrific, and you must have walked around thinking, now I'm the one that's not really fitting in.
You know? It is strange. Yeah, it is strange.
Let me get rid of that. When I use my computer, it, even though I've got my phone off, my computer will say, take the call.
I
don't understand why someone wouldn't at least sit down with me like a doctor, like the surgeon that did all of that, and say, hey, I don't agree with what you did, but I'm looking
glad it worked. Yeah.
Tell me what you did. I'll take notes and I will look at it.
That's right.
They just say, no, I'm not interested in what you did.
Yeah.
I don't understand that.
Well, I've seen what you're talking about when it comes to pediatricians, right? Pediatricians have been put under economic pressure by the insurance companies that if they don't get a certain percentage of their kids vaccinated per the vaccine schedule, they get their insurance cut so drastically that it puts them out of business. And so these guys are really aggressive about it. I first saw that when our kids were young, about 30 years ago, aggressively pushing this vaccine stuff and trying to get us to put them on fluoride pills because we were on well water. This guy was adamant about all this stuff. And I didn't argue with him. We just never went back, you know, but it really is amazing the kind how they have embraced this as their identity, as their profession, and they are as aggressive in terms of pushing this as the people who are directly making the product.
Well, imagine John, I know you've interviewed John Richardson, but imagine what it was like growing up in that house. Your dad's a doctor. He's running for Congress. He's a very popular person in that community, Northern California. And all of a sudden, they come into his office with the guns out.
Wow.
Arrest him and his nurse,
yeah.
Throw him in jail, and then terminate his medical license for giving someone apricot derivatives. What is the matter with these people? You know,
I mean, you'd think
they go, you know, let's ignore them. I mean, if you want to think apricots cure people, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they went to war. And the reason they went to war, they also went to war with Rife, Royal Rife.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing, the Rife microscope, the way the San Diego Tribune wrote the article and said this guy took 8 or 9 patients with stage 4 cancer and they don't have it anymore. What is Dr. Rife doing? They raided his office, took everything he had, terminated his medical license. And unfortunately, he died an early death, probably due to alcohol, because they destroyed his life.
Wow. And that is amazing.
I don't get it. I just don't get it. Yeah. I'm excited about you having this kind of information on your show because you are part of the solution, not the problem.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we have to. I've just seen this in so many different ways. You know, the first time. Kind of interesting, you know, J. Edgar Griffin, you always think about him with the Federal Reserve. First time I was ever censored was because of a report that I did on the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve. So they have these systems that are so vital that they will do anything to anybody who even criticizes or calls into question what these systems are. And it truly is amazing how vigorously they protect themselves with this kind of stuff.
Well, I did an interview with Dr. Contreras Jr., you know, Francisco. He's a surgical oncologist, speaks 3 or 4 languages fluently. This guy didn't fall off the truck yesterday. they interviewed me. They interviewed him. We put it on Facebook. We put it on YouTube, and they took it down.
Yeah.
This guy said nothing acoustic, didn't make fun of anybody, nothing like that, and they just took it all down. This was recently, like a month ago.
Wow.
And he is a director and founder of the Oasis of Hope Hospital, 5-story hospital, 2 operatories, 24-hour nursing, private rooms. And they took it down because I was on there, you know.
Yeah, it truly is amazing. And they do focus on individuals already. You know, everybody talks about how they're going to use, surveillance and control to limit speech and what people can say and post and all the rest of this stuff. It's already happening. It's been happening for quite some time. I mean, after they took my stuff down on YouTube, I put up a Christmas music program, some Christmas music that I'd done on a channel about a year and a half after that. And they took that down after 6 months with no explanation. And so we put up a few things now on YouTube. I don't expect that to last very long. We have to very carefully edit it when we put it up, or we know that it'll all be taken down. But it's just kind of there as a pointer to the other stuff that we do. But that's where we live now. And it's only going to get worse because they're focusing so much on how they can identify people and turn using the Internet into a permission that is granted by them.
Well, I don't know if your viewers know this or not, but you were kind enough to set up a discount. Mm-hmm. May I talk mm-hmm. about that briefly?
Mm-hmm.
The things that I took are available and they are legal mm-hmm. as long as they're purchased as food supplements. Mm-hmm. That's what we're saying today.
Yeah.
And if they log on to rncstore.com, mm-hmm. RNC, like Rick, Nancy, Charlie, store.com, they can order anything that they, you know, the enzymes, the B17, the B15, anything they want. And if they put, I wrote it down, Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T, which I, yeah, it's your last name.
Yeah.
If they put that in at the end of the order, it'll say, do you have a discount code? Mm-hmm. I hate those because I never have one.
Well, you got one now.
I got one now. If they write Knight in there, they'll save 10%. I don't get it. Mm-hmm. You don't get that money. Mm-hmm. That's for your listeners.
That's right.
And your viewers. So they may not know this, but that's a great thing you did. And you may have to go to Rumble with this because you got Ricky on here today. They're after me.
Well, that's where we are. We're on Rumble, BitChute, Odyssey. We're on those platforms. And of course, I'm still on Twitter, but I'm heavily shadow banned there. And we've verified that, but that's just the world that we live in. So, we just accept that and we move on and we do the best that we can. But it truly is an amazing commentary on our government to the extent that nothing that they do surprises me. I mean, if you're going to let people get cancer and if you're going to, pick their pockets as they're dying in agony, then I guess you could pretty much do anything, right? And there's nothing that's taken off the table.
Oasis of Hope just developed an oral B17 liposomal.
Oh.
And compare this now. When I was at the Mayo Clinic, had I stayed and gotten the chemo and the radiation and what they wanted to do, 500,000, 600,000, you can buy a bottle of this stuff for $300. And that's what's driving them crazy.
Yeah.
Because these integrative alternative guys and women put their life on the line and say, you know, there's other ways to do this. And for a little bit of money. And that's what's cooking the deal. That's what's causing the war out in the streets.
That's right.
But I'm going to fight that war. That's right. I'm going to be vocal like you.
Good.
And I'm not going to get shoved around because somebody spoke up and saved my life 51 years ago.
Yes.
How dare I? If somebody says, Rick, you had cancer a long time ago. How'd you get well? Well, you know, I just took what they asked me to take. And No. Yeah.
Well, good for you. Yeah. And we know it's the money. You know that it's the love of money, as Jesus said, the root of all evil, right? And that really is what we see over and over again. There is so much money involved in that. That they will do very evil things to people. So I appreciate you putting that out there. People can educate themselves. Again, if you go to myworldwithoutcancer.com, there's a free book there, download, and they can find that. Is that where your book there is as well?
My book isn't there, but my book is either on rncstore.com or it's at b17works.com if they fill out that little one-page questionnaire. Okay. And I'm HIPAA certified. No one's going to share anything. That's private. But I'll send them a copy of my book. And it's a fun book. I used to do stand-up comedy. And I don't know how funny cancer is, but What they tried to do to me was funny.
Yeah.
And I'm not funny, haha, funny odd.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they can get all that. Even Amazon carries my book.
Oh.
So, yeah. You know, we've got a few people that are still willing to be okay. Yeah, I'm feeling fine. I'm 150 pounds. I'm 5'9". I don't take any prescription drugs. I've never had chemo, never had radiation, and I've never had a relapse in 51 years. And I got that Mayo Clinic letter that you've read and proved.
That's right.
That said, I'm not lying about this.
That's right.
And my slides are preserved in paraffin at the Mayo Clinic because when I wrote them and told them I was going to sue them, they got ready. So, we're telling the truth.
That's great.
And we're not, but we're not, I'm not prescribing. I'm not telling people, yes, you can get well. What I'm saying is I got well.
Mm-hmm.
And if that sounds like a good idea, I'm willing to talk to you about it and, you know, move the ball down the field.
That's great that you're doing that. It's just a sad commentary on our government that you have to be so careful about how you present this information or they will attack you. I mean, that in and of itself is just offensive when you look at how they police all this information and, you know, call it whatever they want to call it. But I'm used to that. I mean, there's so many different topics that they will cancel you for, but that is one of the key ones that's there. Again, B17 Works, W-O-R-K-S. .com and oasisofhope.com and also rncstore.com, and that's where you can use the code NIGHT to get some books as well as supplements that they sell there and get a 10% discount off of that. Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. Night with a K.
That's right. Thank you so much, Rick. Appreciate your story, and I'm glad that you that it all worked out for you, and it's good. We're glad that you're doing fine. I just think back of all the friends and family that I've lost to cancer, and
my father, my sister never came out of a coma. What is that about?
My sister died at the age of 50 with cancer, and she went to the MD Anderson Clinic, and they messed her up really bad. It was difficult. Last couple of months of her life really was. So it's something that really hits home in my family, and I want to get this information out. So thank you so much for coming on, Rick. I appreciate it.
I enjoyed being here, and every time you call me, I'll come running.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, Rick Hill and myworldwithoutcancer.com, B17works.com, oasisofhope.com, and of course, rncstore.com, where you can get some of the things that they talk about.
Making sense common again.
You're listening to The David Knight Show.
Well, joining us now is Sasha Paparik, and he has an international perspective on the real estate market. You know, we have a way that we have here in America of buying and selling houses, which is different than the rest of the world. We've only seen one way for several decades, but even that way is undergoing a lot of different changes. We've had major lawsuits between brokerages and others fighting each other in court in terms of how listings are going to be done, how real estate is going to be done, commissions and things like that. Two major lawsuits for the National Association of Realtors, one in 2023 that was $1.8 billion, and then there was another one for $400-something million that happened in 2024. Meanwhile, there are lawsuits going back and forth between big brokerage companies like REMAX and a service called Compass that is doing exclusive listings for a short period of time before they put them out for multiple listing. And so that's created a competition between Compass and Zillow. So Sasha has a company that is the first international real estate platform. So I thought it'd be kind of interesting to get his perspective on how things are rapidly changing here in the United States, as well as what is customary internationally. So joining us now is Sasha Poparik, the founder of Immobilium, I guess is the way you pronounce it. Is that correct?
Correct, excellent. And thank you, David. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Well, thank you for coming on. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. A lot of tech changes are really happening. And I think even when we look at the ability of artificial intelligence to go through and sort through a large amount of data and bring that home and make some sense of it, we're not at the point yet where the AI agents are really working that well. But theoretically, you could have an AI agent that would go out and look at listings, and you tell it you want to be in this general area, and you give it some other parameters, maybe about schools or this or that, and have it do a sort through of all the data that's out there and present candidates to you. Well, what do you think is going to be happening in the real estate market?
Wow. We had this like little chat before we started it, and you know, I think that a major thing that's going to happen is that, unfortunately or fortunately, agents are going to become more and more obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I remember
human agents. You mean real estate agents?
Absolutely. The physical appearance of an agent, because the work that agents provide today, it's not even as close what was happening 10, 15, I'm not even talking about 20 years ago. I mean, you as a seller, let's say in 2000s, early 2000s, were hiring an agent who like would go like and break his or her leg and show it in the house and take pictures and do all these documentations, applications, anything for you, which was rightfully something that would earn the agent 5% of the commission or 6% of the commission, depends on the area.
Exactly, yeah.
Today's age, I mean, I am not sure what agents are actually doing except being like, you know, Instagram models. It's, you know, you can say, okay, so people are going to look at me now because I have tons of friends who are agents and tons of friends who are brokers. And I think they already know this whole thing. This whole COVID period shook that tree of 400,000 agents in California alone. You know, coming down to maybe like only 30% of them actually selling something. And, you know, because every single agent prior the COVID, prior the interest rates coming to just few percent and was making $200,000 a year, buying the brand new Beamers, buying amazing purses, like if it was a female agent. And it was like irritating the neighbor next door who was actually doing something else, being a hostess of being like, you know, a receptionist. And then she goes to neighbors like, oh my God, how do you make all this money? It was seller's market. Properties being sold left and right. And then they go, look, you just go do your test 3-4 months, you know, whatever, you get your license and join my brokerage. And I'm going to give you so many deals because the market is looking for buyers, you know, to accumulate. And everyone was making money. When COVID hit, after the COVID, the economy started crashing down, all these things, most of the agents fell off. And they go back to their own roots, back to being hairstylists, back to be hostess, back to be receptionist. There was nothing on the market, there was no sales, but not just that, there was nothing that could contribute towards the helping the industry grow. Mm-hmm. And I think that that era has pushed technology to that roof, because every single agent who was sticking to this own gun, you know what, I'm going to stick to this thing. They were looking for ways how to utilize on technology itself and how to, you know, monetize to make it easier for them to sell the property. Mm-hmm. So technology became its own beast, its own entity, its own, so to say, a beam parallel towards the real estate industry. And people are start slowly adapting towards technology on enormous ways. So technology grew up next to the whole market. Now you're coming with concepts like Compass. Compass and Refkin, which is an amazing, amazing brain of a human. Like, he saw that. He saw that tech is, future. And so did others. So did Zillow. So is Google right now. And it's becoming more and more relevant for you to use technology as a tool and making it so accessible and so easier to even the agents who are not tech savvy to actually utilize the sales. I remember when we built our own tech in the early 2020s, and I was going, and it was this blockchain thing, and people were asking, what is blockchain? Crypto was on top. Everyone was buying Bitcoin. Everyone was buying Dogecoin. Everyone was buying all these coins. Everyone was making money. Mm-hmm. So agents themselves who are not so tech savvy would automatically associate blockchain and all this new technology to Bitcoin. As long as it was working and Bitcoin was rising, so to say the crypto was rising, they were the biggest fan of the tech. Mm-hmm. The crypto started crashing down. So much scam was happening. They were like then literally eliminating everything that they actually got associated with when it came to technology. They didn't want to deal with this thing that even us had to bury this whole amazing concept of transparency, security, and transaction on a global level and put the agents first, the human factor first. Mm-hmm. Which for us actually helped us build this franchise. It was actually a blessing in disguise, adding human factor and adding, you know, this whole agents on top of it to make us grow. Now, Compass sees, hold on a second, we built something significant. We are expanding. We've been throughout and straightforward through this whole real estate winter and crypto winter, and there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Why do we have to now really deal whatever a National Association of Realtors, NAR, is dictating? Mm-hmm. There is no point of that. The same way that people see MLS as the major platform dictating their own ways. And Compass said, hey, I'm going to go and do it my own way. And this well with NAR, and that's why the lawsuits are starting.
Yeah. It is kind of interesting. As you're talking about this, what value do they add? And I remember when we bought a house in the early 80s, and we were in Texas, we were buying a house in North Carolina, and we had an agent who did what you were talking about. They would physically go around to the different places and take, you know, at the time they had in the early 80s, they had like a fax machine that would give them a text description only of this property. And so they could look at it, see how many square feet it was and bedrooms and things like that. But they didn't have any way to actually transmit pictures. So they would go around and take pictures of it. They'd spend a lot of time looking at it and that type of thing. But and then narrowing it down, talking to us, narrowing it down. And then when we came to visit, they had a list of places that we could go look at. But since then, I've been scratching my head and saying, you know, what do I really need an agent for? Because if we've got the capability to look at these listings online with pictures and all the rest of the stuff, I'm doing all the legwork, actually finger work, right? Looking at all these different things with the databases there. And what value are the agents really adding to any of that? And I think furthermore, when we look at it, probably the time is coming where you'd be able, not too far off, somebody's going to put something in, let you do a virtual house tour that's going to be kind of three-dimensional, right? And you won't need to physically go there. You get a very good idea of it. You'll still want to go probably and kick the tires. But the being able to get a sense of the space and being able to move through it and that type of thing, I think that's probably the next thing that's coming. So the question then, you know, is what function do these agents bring to it? And I think that's a key thing that's there. What you have now is an institution that was set up for a different time when people didn't have that kind of information at their fingertips, and it's become an anachronism, I think. And so there's going to be a lot of changes. So when you look at, as an international agency, talk to us about how it's different in other countries in terms of the house buying experience than in America.
I think that, as you just said, and, you know, I completely agree with you, an agent had to come to you, fill up the papers, sign here, fax it, go, show you, drive you around. Oh, mm-hmm. my God, my first properties in the 90s. Actually, I got tired driving around with an agent who set everything up. I could not even imagine that I had to deal with this thing, that I had to deal with, you know, sellers, with seller's agent, with escrow, with title. Mm-hmm. Because the security and transparency through technology did not exist. Today, you sign everything with DocuSign. You don't even have to go to notary anymore. There is RON, remote online notarization, that you and I can now really be with a third party notary public through a video call and authorize everything. So I don't have to leave the house. The problem is this thing is still not there. It's the getting used to a factor. The same way it took you a long time to switch from a cab, from a taxi into an Uber. Mm-hmm. The same way it took you a long time to switch from a BlackBerry to an iPhone. You cannot even imagine not having, like, you know, a keyboard to type. Like, what is an iPhone? You were fighting it while technology was there and growing it. Mm-hmm. More and more people are getting comfortable with dealing with their own thing. Now, you're going to say, is 5-6% commission worth it for an agent to collect on a property that's been sold to an agent? In today's age, today's society, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. Because most of the work is already be prepared by a seller. If the seller is really wants to put some effort, they can deal with with title company. They can deal with escrow. They can deal with inspection. There is still this securing concept of a buyer not trusting the seller. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're buying something from your brother next door. You're buying to someone that do know. So that's why they're using these brokerages, because brokerage is, so to say, someone who guarantees that the process, the legitimacy of the process is going to be completed right. And that's when the seller and buyers are needing a third party. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, if I will meet you now and we put something on a paper and it's like, okay, let's just be honest with each other. Let's go through inspection together. Let's go through this together. We both can bypass 5-6% commission. The only thing that's needed here is an escrow, which is something that, like, until we submit all the paperwork, is the main factor of holding this transaction and the money. Agents, what I'm seeing where agents are needed, it's like in art business. You know, it's easy for you to sell an emerging artist's painting who now through your show can showcase it. Look what I have. Go to one of these platforms and buy it. And you say, okay, great. When you are coming to like Picasso's, when you are coming to Frida Kahlo's or Pollock's, or those really abstract or like very expensive collectors, artists, they're worth millions and millions of dollars, you need millions of dollars equivalent buyers. Mm-hmm. Those guys, they don't sit around. They don't look through Zillow. They do not actually just, you know, knock on doors. They need specific group of agents who are having buyers catalogs, who are having sellers catalogs, because these people have enough money to actually not deal with agents. And when a $10 million property with 5% commission costs $500,000 out of seller's pocket, it makes sense because the sale of a $10 million or $20 million mansion was done faster. Mm-hmm. These individuals may always need some agents. But if I have a $400,000 condo in, I don't know, call it like Phoenix, Arizona, you know, I don't know why I need an agent for. What this agent is going to do? The place is on the market. It's nothing extravagant. As long as you get yourself a loan and you can tell me that you have a proof of funds, I'm there to close the deal and to save us 20 grand. Why not?
Yeah.
So those are the things that I'm seeing agents being still part of some society down the road versus like being associated with every single property on the market.
Yeah, when you're talking about the high-end properties, it reminds me when I've been to Jackson Hole, I see the real estate dealers that are there, places like Sotheby's, you know, because you think of as a fine art auction house. And because the properties are so expensive, that's what they're doing, and actually using the analogy that you did, that you got somebody that is going to be connected to the very wealthy people who could pay that kind of money for a home there in Jackson Hole. So I agree with you with that. But in terms of the bread and butter stuff that is out there, the ordinary size homes, it's a huge commission to pay when there's not a lot of services that are being provided there. So tell us a little bit about your international real estate platform, and how is that different than what we see that's out there right now? Have we lost him? Yeah. Okay. Let's try to reconnect.
I think we got a cut off.
Oh, okay, so, we did. Yeah, that's right. Okay, we're back now. So tell us a little bit about your platform, Mobilium, and it's the first international real estate platform. How does that operate that's different from what Americans are used to seeing through realestate.com and Zillow and their local agents?
Well, as an American real estate industry, you're always kind of associate what's in your backyard, what's close to you. You know, I have friends of mine who I'm trying to sway over to buy amazing properties in, like, you know, Spain, in Greece, even Africa, Dubai, you know, South America, amazing deals. Now with Maduro gone in Venezuela, there's so many deals over there. And we all know that Venezuela, potentially where we have our operation, it's at one point going to be probably like the most prosperous country in South America. But like now convincing you, David, to tell you, hey, why don't you buy a $10 million hotel in Isla Margarita, Venezuela? You would tell me, Sasha, this is all great, but I do not know anything about that area. And I tell you, dude, you're going to make three times the money what you're going to make in Los Angeles, because national, like, increase in properties in California, it's like 10% versus, let's say, what's happening overseas. Mm-hmm. You're going to tell me, Sasha, I like my 10% because I don't know the law, the rules, the regulations, or anything like that, versus something that could be overseas. Now, this is coming from someone who is more stationary located in the areas of your own, so to say, vicinity. But major companies, major investors, they don't buy anything local. It's already over exaggerating. They want to actually buy something that's 30 cents on a dollar. And those are the guys that actually use us or like any other major international franchises to purchase properties in, you know, St. Lucia, or purchase properties in different other countries with security and transparency. So what we did, we actually created technology that allows all this transaction to happen, connecting with the banking systems, connecting with converting crypto into a fiat. That's a major concept that some countries still do not accept, you know, crypto payments. So we are converting them and, you know, sending fiat, which means dollars or euros, into those countries. And of course, securities, you know. Here you have in America, almost by default, inspection, title, as you say, like escrow. In other countries, you don't. So for you to just go and buy something in another country, it's like a risk that you're taking unless you have somewhere there on the ground doing that legwork for you, doing this security for you. Mm-hmm. And what we actually have done, we have so far 102 global locations in 60 countries. So we syndicated boutique brokerages to be under our umbrella, to be under our franchise. We still told them to keep their own identity. Mm-hmm. That's another aspect of international way of thinking. Oh, you're going to come here as a predator. You're going to take my name away. It's not Travis Knight anymore. Now it's Remax. So we said, no. How about you still Travis Knight and we just give you the roof over your head and technology to make you more transparent to international buyers? And then you say, okay, great. I'm happy about that. Like it's a sensitive concept. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing, we are not just catering to an American buying something in Malta. What we are doing, we are focusing on where the diaspora, the immigration is, like focusing to access those like centers. Well, let's say there is a 500,000 Greeks living in Chicago. So pretty much they're going to be 99% buyers of the Greek properties in Greek islands or something like that. We're not going to force feed some American telling, dude, buy this thing in Athens. We're going to go to Greek communities. We're going to go to Greek cultural centers and say, hey, we are here to help you buy something from back home. Because eventually you may just go back, immigrate, retire, and be where you came from. Mm-hmm. And by starting that, we open those doors, those pipelines, where now even in Americans who have nothing to do with, let's say, Greece in general, as an example, are willing to purchase properties there. And why? Because there's many incentives buying, let's say, properties in Europe. You can actually secure yourself a EU residency, European residency, by buying a 250,000 euros property, a piece of real estate in Greece. And it gives you something which is called a golden visa, which is equivalent to like a green card in America. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Allows you to stay in Greece. And it's a first step for you to become potentially a passport of European Union and immigrate over there. Mm-hmm. Other countries have similar concepts, similar plans like Malta, Portugal, Hungary. And so they're actually doing exactly the same that what America is doing. You know, come here, invest money, stay here. Now they say, hey, why don't you move to Europe? You've been tired of American way of life, you know, immigrate mm-hmm. over here and you can travel to Europe. And so those are the ways that we have set up, not just for Europe, Latin America, you know, Africa as well, and a bunch of other areas.
I see. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. You know, years ago, I remember John Davidson, who was with the National Taxpayers Union, one of the things he was saying was, you want to try to make sure you got what he called residential ambiguity. You know, am I really, I have a footprint in several different countries, and he looked at it as a way of kind of keeping your foot in the door for freedom. You know, if it gets really bad in one area, you can get out. Of course, we've had a lot of people who have emigrated out of the United States because of things that they see happening here. Speaking of international situations, just as kind of an aside, I know this wasn't what you came on to talk about, but let's talk a little bit about Venezuela. Can you kind of give us a temperature reading as to what's going on there? How are people reacting to the situation that's happened after Maduro's been taken out?
I'm a dreamer. I am a visionary. I'm mm-hmm. delusional. That's why I actually build my businesses. Like I just go and say, you know, whatever the hell kind of stays around. I have a good friend of mine. his name is, he's one of the lawyers. I'm not going to mention it, but top lawyer in LA. And, I was visiting him once and he has like in downtown, like probably like the whole building of lawyers, like 60, 70 lawyers. And they take, every case that comes towards them. And I go to him, Mark. Okay, well, the cat is out of the bag. So Mark, why all that? He goes, Sasha, I throw everything against the wall, whatever it sticks. And, you know, that's actually kind of worth building all my businesses on my life. But to jump to Venezuela, we went there when no one else did because I realized there is no competition. We went into Africa where everyone else is going out. And now I think we are the biggest African network in 16 countries. So are we already positioned in Greenland. So we are already in Ukraine. When the war started, we went in Ukraine, we opened 4 locations. We know that that war is going to stop one day and we're going to have a position. Venezuela was always controversial for us. And as a, you know, hopeful I was, I knew that I have to be pragmatic. I have to be realistic. What's the downside and what's the downfall of if things don't work out? And I saw that, like, we didn't know anything illegal. We were just a real estate company, you know, being positioned there. But we knew that the population of Venezuela, that whole area there, they needed an open door. They need to open the gates, need that. And I think that Maduro in general was more a symbol than anything else. I don't think that he was a flexing muscles or something like that. And the moment, you know, even prior Maduro's, we had deals that we were offering to people. They were scared. Mm-hmm. No one like that. I have one of my partners who's actually not even a U.S. citizen. And he's like, dude, you have to go there and like do some deals. No, I'm scared. I'm going to get arrested. He's like, nobody's going to arrest you, man. Nobody cares. Trust me. But people were scared and they didn't want to even look at Venezuela as a vision and not even buy something. Now things have changed. So we have requests for land purchases. People are asking us where exactly the, you know, oil raffineries are. When it comes to Venezuela, this area is it. That's it. It's stabilizing. It's going to become probably the most prosperous market in South America. It's going to dominate. Some people say, you know, I missed my chance with El Salvador and I'm going to miss with Venezuela because, as I said, prior to that, everyone was scared of those areas. So they say it's El Salvador, Panama. Those are the kind of like, you know, tunnels they're building when it comes to wealth, when it comes to money making. And of course, it needs real estate. So most of people are not approaching us. Even still, they're like very candidly looking and cautiously looking at this area. But the smart investors are asking us about land purchases, commercial real estate purchases, hotels, anything that has a potential of accommodating the new way of, so to say, migration. And who are the first in that line are exactly the industries that are going to participate the most. That's the oil industries. Mm-hmm. So that's been required. It's close to the oil raffineries, oil like drilling positions. Then the lands that are available to purchasing, you know, to build hotels, to build like pretty much like housings for the first tier of immigrants who are going to be the workers for all these big oil companies. Mm-hmm. Next to it are now more and more interest. Not as Caracas itself. I don't think that area has any appealing concept unless you are bringing some business headquarters. But from a residential point of view, people are feeling more and more now confident looking into, you know, islands there, Venezuelan, like Isla Margarita. It's between Curaçao and I think Aruba or these areas. And because those are deals there that could be now turned into Airbnbs. Everything that Venezuela was missing for all these years, it's shifting down there from a business perspective.
Yeah, that was the amazing thing about Venezuela, by talking about the tremendous natural resources that they had and why this should be one of the wealthiest countries on earth. And yet, because of politics and other things like that, it really kept that from happening. So what you're doing is you're helping people to identify, I guess we could say, fixer-upper economies that are there. Not just a particular house in a particular neighborhood, but seeing where there's a region that is poised to really grow, I guess. How would you advise people in terms of investing in real estate, especially internationally?
Well, I mean, not that I'm trying to put myself first in this game. Absolutely not. I see that we are in the beginning stage of what we are going to be, especially with technology that you mentioned. And you mentioned how AI now kind of can give you the whole scenario. And I'm I was associating with this company that actually are Canadians, and they moved to Dominican Republic, and they built this software even 4 years ago that AI was just starting. Mm-hmm. And they were literally, the reason they did that because Dominican Republic has the biggest influx of Canadian immigrants. They live in Canada, moving to the Dominican Republic because it's one of the biggest economies in this whole Caribbean belt. So they didn't know where to move. So they created the software in-house, those couple of programmers, and they said, hey, I want to move to Dominican Republic, but, you know, I have a father who is 80 years old, and he cannot walk far enough, and I want to make sure there is a bench, you know, in front of the house, and I want to make sure that, like, there is no school close to it because school's allowed. So they build this software. What it does, it actually searches 7 billion points of like photos through Google Map and analyzes every single area where any house is for sale. So now when you have like, when you go to a listing and you see, you know, all these filters, you see like, oh, I want a 3-bedroom house with like 2 bathrooms and accepts dogs and it's close to here and close to there. And you can look it on a map, but you don't know if there is like traffic light close to it or if it has this, you know, yeah, which schools. So pretty much you going there and you seeing one segment, but not 3 days later, it may bother you that there is kids there coming out of school every single day and you just $3 million house. So this software, even back then, can pretty much give you the whole scenario. You give the whole scenario where you should move, then eliminates all the other listings in that area that would actually be a problematic for your way of life.
Wow.
Now imagine how far this thing is going to go, you know, yeah, coming down the road. And it's just going to help people move abroad. Mm-hmm. Moving abroad was a taboo, was something scaring, was something like, I don't know if I make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get scammed, absolutely scammed. That was the whole major aspect why we built that. And I remember sitting at our early stages in 2020s in one of the offices in Beverly Hills. We didn't even have an office. It was Covet Banker's office in Beverly Hills. And one of our friend was the GM there and he brought us there and we had like this thing called AMA, like Ask Me Anything, where mm-hmm. people log in from around the world and ask us about our platform and about our, you know, concept. And we try to impress who is who from the industry. There was like leaders from like Fidelity, leaders from like Sotheby's, leader from everyone watching us. And more people were joining with questions. They were from Africa, from Nigeria or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to be a bigot and not to take their questions. So I took, you know, 1, 2, 3 questions. And at one point, I was like, okay, this is not looking good for me because I was hoping someone from London is going to join in and ask me how to buy a property in Beverly Hills or some Tokyo, how to buy property in, let's say, like, I don't know, like Dubai. So I said, you know, let me double down on that. So I open up a conversation with that individual and the gentleman asked me like, when are you guys going to open your location in Lagos, Nigeria? And I'm like, okay, I don't even know where that is, you know. So I'm Googling while I'm talking. I was like, okay, I see it. And I ask him, I'm not sure, sir, we're going to look for it. We're just opening now those big metropolitan areas, Barcelona, this and that. And I ask him, but I don't understand how we would make money. And then he goes, we do not trust our own family sending money to put as a down payment. Imagine sending money to an agent who is somewhere there and with the idea that it's going to be safe because they don't have escrows on there. They don't have things like we have in America, which is beauty of money security. And that was this aha moment when I asked him, but who is actually buying most of these places? He goes, our immigrants, our diaspora who are all over the world. And that was this like, you know, RAM opening a door for us, how to position ourselves and how to actually assist the buyers. And from that end, everything went on the other direction, which means then we start allocating where an American who would love to retire can move without any hesitation or any kind of worries that his or her money is going to be stolen, the transaction is going to be done, that, you know, that the property is going to be, as they said, especially for a reason of no escrow, especially for a reason that there is properties, they are not in register like here. As much as we complain about NAR, N-A-R, or Compass doing one thing, or Zillow or whatever, are the most secure real estate market in the world, because real estate in America, it's commodity. In the world, it's something that people go there, they buy and they sell. People here know they're going to stick here for next 20, 30 years. They have a value. The prices are going to go, even if inflation is, you know, going to eat some of this appreciation, so to say, it's still going to be valuable 20 years later that like your kids can inherit it, versus in a world when you have to have tons of components, they're going to help you out. So we position those components, we position those tools, and we are pretty much the most transparent platform and concept around that for any kind of purchases. Doesn't matter if it's residential, commercial, hotels, casinos, islands, name it. We are there to assist
and help. Well, I imagine most Americans, you know, most of us are not, most of us are not in the market for a casino. That's a Trump family, I guess, but the, most of us are not in the market for that, but there might still be reasons for us to, do investment abroad. What kind of advice would you offer for people who are kind of middle class in America?
There is, there is a lot of incentives. Everyone loves Americans as much as there is, could be rhetoric about that. Everyone loves American money. And, you know, so there is areas that you have to feel comfortable. Like, you know, there's people that, you know, we sold properties in Mauritius, you know, that actually it's growing exponentially. It used to be just an island, where the main source of GDP was agriculture, but now they changed to the industry and they're making it now more, changing to like, tourism, changing towards like, you know, opening doors to more migrants coming there, retiring over there. It's much more affordable lifestyle. So people ask, okay, what are pros and cons to go there? And once there is a wave of developments, there is many deals, you know. So the point is, what are you buying this thing for? Are you buying this property so you can rent it out and have yourself some kind of like passive income? Or are you buying this thing to move there and live there? And that all depends on particular buyer. You know, if people want to retire and they want to have like more affordable way of life, because, you know, if they have any 401k, it doesn't matter. Let's call it a 401k. It's $500,000. That $500,000 in America, it's not going to last much longer.
That's right.
If you're comparing it to different areas. Now, what they had was something close to them. They were moved to Mexico. Then we maybe moved to Caribbean islands somewhere they were associating. They never thought about moving to South America, moving to, you know, Indian Ocean area like Mauritius, Seychelles, all these areas, or Europe. So we, the deals there are significant. And I think that especially with options for you as an individual residential buyer, which is not the case in America, to purchase a condo, a house, and secure yourself a residency, which can open the door for the rest of the European countries, for example, it's an appealing incentive, and it's something that drives people to invest more, more, and more.
Yeah, and of course, I hear more and more from people who have lived abroad. They just can't believe how expensive everything is here in America. So that's one of the key things that's driving people, even for retirement, you know, that they still have their Social Security or whatever, but they can actually live off of it if they go to another country. So I guess you see that a lot.
No, no, correct. And, but you know what it is? Unless you're there, you know, most of the people, let's generalize the American society. And 99% of the people who ever left this country, there's people who never did, whoever left this country, most of them, they went on a vacation trip, two, 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And
very structured. Yeah. Everything's a guided tour. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. So maybe they went first time. They say, you know what? Let me test Greece one more time. Let me test Spain. After 3-4 times, you said, you know what? It's actually really beautiful here. So how can I live here? However, they never end up staying there longer than a couple of months and kind of acclimatizing themselves to the society. And me being European, I'm actually coming from Switzerland. I understand how easy to come to America and adjust to the American way of life. It's not a tourism. You have to stay here. Mm-hmm. You have to deal with problems, deal with issues, deal with, like, you know, fixing yourself, like, you know, work permits. Like, it was a concept 30 years ago that I have to endure and go that. I didn't just come here as a tourist. So the shoe is on another foot for an American to say, okay, I'm not going to go there as a tourist anymore. I want to go there and stay. So how can I do that? You know, how much money do I need? What are my options? And in comparing to America, in order for you to live here, you have to be an extraordinary person to get like O-1 visa or to bring a business, to invest into a business to get like this EB-5 or E-2 visa or, you know, get married, green card or stuff like that. There is situations that are on a table, but they are much more complex. Europe offers incentives that you can buy a condo and secure yourself a residency. Now that investment is yours. You're not going to lose it. Here in America, if you spend, let's say, $200,000 on a business, that's going to secure you a residency for a couple of years. If your business goes down, you lost money. You know, you lost $200,000 and mm-hmm. you're going back with nothing. In Europe, you can actually buy a property, get a residency, and let you explore if that country is really for you, if Europe is really for you. Worst case scenario, you're going to say, you know what? I've been here 2-3 years. I'm going to go back to America. I still have my European residency. And guess what? I have a property over there that I may rent even if I'm not there, or I can sell it and get my money back. Mm-hmm. Those are crucial differences between moving from America to Europe hypothetically and vice versa.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So this year, what do you see happening in real estate this year? Kind of the economy has been, there's a lot of clouds hanging over the economy. People are concerned about what's going to happen with the AI bubble and if that thing is going to bust. What do you see happening with real estate then?
Real estate is finally coming to its senses. Okay. So all these people are realizing, especially the sellers.
Mm-hmm.
One, those prices of like, you know, millions of dollars, my property is jumping left and right. I'm going to stick with it. I'm not going to sell it. It's not going to work. You know, mm-hmm. you have to come down with your prices. The reason is that the interest rates, even though as much as they fall down, they're here to stay. This now 6.5, that's it. That's the bottom. 6%, it's the new 3%. You know, it's never going to go down. I hope it's never, because then we are in crisis. Each time an interest rate is going to like literally under the anything that government can borrow, you know, it means like they need to reset the market. That's why they offer those interest rates in 2020s to keep the, you know, this whole country alive.
Mm-hmm.
And purchase the property at 3% in 2020 at a half of the price value right now should be crazy to sell it. Why would you? Because even if you cash out certain, you know, gains, what are you going to do with that money? You're going to go back on the market and buy something with more, like, you know, APR and with a higher price. Mm-hmm. You're not going to do it. You're going to stick to what you have. That's why there is more properties on the market for sale than a buyers. But these properties, they were past the 3 or 4% interest rates. Anyone who's selling a property now sold it, you know, it's either refinancing from a 10% to 6, or is getting rid of it because it was just a vision for that individual to flip it at one point of time. Since there is a buyer's market and buyers dictating the tempo, You know, the properties prices are going to go down for sure, 20 to 30% from whatever it is right now. And the buyers on the other end are going to understand that 6%, that's it. I can never go cheaper than that. I have to figure out how to purchase this. The biggest problems they are coming along are not even the prices of the properties or interest rates. It's insurance. The insurance prices went through.
Yeah, especially like in California, for example. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Anything you touch, it doesn't matter if you want to insure your own puppy. You know, it's like over 200%. I'm not even talking about houses because the major insurance companies, especially with Pacific Palisades fires and all these things that happened, you know, last year, they literally exodus California. It's becoming a danger zone. It's becoming something that they definitely going to go in bankrupt. So whoever stayed raised the premiums through the roof. And if you do not pay attention that even on a national, you know, nationwide, you know, base, you may end up paying like double interest rates because if your house is now, you know, paying almost half of your mortgage on insurance, you're going to think twice if you're going to buy this house.
Yeah. You know, how does that compare internationally? I mean, if you go to some of these countries, not even in a developing area, but even in Europe, what is the insurance situation like there?
Insurance itself, as I said, America, who the hell knows what's going to happen? And I'm sorry to use this word, H-E-L-L. But I think that once this whole economy kind of settled down, everything else is going to settle down. And people are taking too much advantages. It's just one of those do never let the good crisis go to waste situation that the big corporations and big companies are. I mean, there is no reason for you to pay $1,000 a month on your car, you know, insurance. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for that. You know, but they don't give you an option. So at one point, this all has to legalize, has to come to certain terms that otherwise it won't be sustainable. Now, when it comes to real estate itself, as I said, it's a tree that has too many rotten apples, too many rules and regulations. Technology is going full speed. I remember even back in the days I mentioned in an earlier a part of the interview, like something like RON, remote online notarization, was taboo in most of the states because notary public, it's an industry on its own.
Yeah, so they're like little guilds that they've got, like a union or a guild or something, and they protect their little territory there, right? Yeah, make it illegal.
So that's why they were making tons of money. And let's say, I'm not going to give you the wrong data, but let's say 2 years ago, out of 50 states, 31 had remote online notarization options because of the COVID shifted this whole technology to be, you know, acceptable. Mm-hmm. Well, let's say states didn't, and that's California. So anywhere else, we could have finished the deal that like I'm in California and you're in New York and I can buy your property like literally with a camera, like, oh, this is it. And in California, no, you're in the presence of a notary public, which means you have to fly from New York to do that. So technology, I think it's taking charge. And once certain rules and regulations come into a place, and especially with crypto situation, I think it's going to be parabolic. Mm-hmm. Because all that part of this blockchain, all the part that's been built that's not, it's not legit, it's just not acceptable to the society, to the regulatory systems. Once it's set in stone, it's going to be an open market for tech to be a dominant part, and then brokerages and agents are going to come there as a tool. So it's going to flip the switch. Here, tech is a tool. Few years from now, agents and humans are going to be the tool towards technology.
That's interesting. Yeah. We were talking about insurance, and of course that comes into the bigger issue of affordability. And, you know, we have a very expensive prices here in America. Our insurance is very high. How does that compare to like Europe and some developing markets in terms of insurance?
I think that the insurance in general, and I'm seeing some other countries, you know, it's jumped everywhere because, you know, be talking about economies were tanking, the whole interest rates were jumping, so everything kind of went with it. But here in America, it's more about shares for the shareholder and price per share earnings. And the more they generate, the more the money the stock market is going to make. Mm-hmm. It's not close to the level in Europe. Why? Because America has its own one system rules, where in Europe, even though you're part of European Union, every single country has their own rules and regulations. So the insurance there in Switzerland and the rates are not the same that are in Germany or France or Portugal. Mm-hmm. They are kind of based on the local economies. Here in America, even though we have states and they are kind of independent, but at the end of the day, certain rates, they're federalized and they're pushing it across the board. In Europe, it's like they have to adjust to each other. Why I'm saying that? Like, because if one country that's part of the European Union cannot keep up with the other country because it's less prosperous, so they are helping the less prosperous country not to pull the whole European Union down. And that's why the control, it's more towards regional aspect versus global European or international aspects.
That's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about what you do with your company. And, of course, I'll just spell this out for people. The name is IMMOBILIUM, Immobilium, yep. Okay, and people.com. And people can find that. What kind of a service do you provide to them in terms of taking all your expertise and experience in these different markets together? What is it that they find from your corporation?
Sure. First of all, it's spelled immobilium.io. I as an Ivan O, because it's a tech company.
Oh, so okay. .io, not .com. Yeah. Okay.
Well, we, from a tech perspective, we secure fastest way of purchasing property where you literally, if everything is intact, you can buy it like as if you were on Amazon buying shoes. So on both ends, like with one click purchase, that's our motto. Like, you know, if we have something now in Spain, let's say in Ibiza, there is a property there. So what we do, we already pre-vet this property. We do inspections. We collect documentations like from a sellers. It's already done. It's like a product. We're putting it on a platform. So there is no reason for you now to fly to Spain to check this property. There is no reason for you to deal with 6 weeks escrow, due diligence, research. We did all that prior putting it on a property. So the buyer comes and see, oh, this is ready to go. We are not wasting time. So let me conclude this transaction. And so that's one aspect, you know, assuring that product as in real estate as a product, it's ready to go, because that's the only one asset in the world that actually it's not, there is no option to buy it as you're buying, you know, shoes.
Right, right. But it's encumbered with a lot of technicalities, yeah.
And the reason is why? Because the real estate, it's part of the local economy. It's almost a commodity. It's, you're paying taxes. You know, the government owns the land. Like, there's so much there that you cannot just buy real estate. Oh, you have to do background check. We're doing AML, anti-money laundering, KYC, knowing your customers. So even our buyers have to be known, so we can make it much, much easier for the seller to accept that transactional purchase. And so we open these doors that people go all around. They come to us. Okay, let us close this transaction through you guys. Because you have, so to say, troops on the ground in Spain helping us out, that we do not have to fly to Spain to actually check the property. Someone over there is going to do all this thing for us, all due diligence, all that's necessity of this transaction, and I'm still here in California. Now, we went so far that, like, you don't even have to ever fly to Spain to buy these properties if you want. We can do all the documentations online for you. But if you will, that's the icing on a cake. You go there to pick up your keys. So you don't have to fly going back and forth and waste time. Mm-hmm. Not just that. Mm-hmm. Whenever you go to Europe, whenever you go to any other countries, Most of the time you go on vacation. You're not going to go and spend 2-3 weeks looking for a properties. Mm-hmm. You go there to relax. And when you go back, you never went to any country as a tourist and say, oh my God, how many days we have? 4. Let's just go buy something. These things don't happen. You go back and you say, I loved Spain. I want to go back there. I want us to live. What's the next step? And then the steps is like, well, let me call some local agents in Spain. Most of these agents don't maybe even speak English. And you just, this whole dream of moving abroad collapses for you. It's becoming too complicated. Mm-hmm. But with us, we do all the diligence prior. We are assisting and helping you as the buyer have the smoothest possible concept available.
That's very interesting. There's one other thing, too, in terms of affordability. You know, one of the trends that we see happening here in the United States is there's a lot of states and a lot of talk by politicians about eliminating property taxes. And what is the property tax situation that you typically see, let's say, in the EU? Are they pretty high, I would imagine?
Each country has their own rules and regulations. Mm-hmm. Each country has their own taxes. Each country has their own availability or allowance who can purchase properties. So there is no general rule. And to be honest with you, with that said, even the way and timelines, how long can it take for you to actually purchase property are not set in stone. The taxes in let's say in Switzerland are much more different than the taxes in Germany. The regulations are different. Like in, let's say if you want to buy properties in Switzerland, even though Switzerland is not part of European Union, but let's just say it has the same structure, you cannot be just an individual. You know, they don't want to deflate the market. They don't want to work with flipping properties like you're doing in America. You buy one day, you sell it tomorrow, you know. Yeah. So they are overprotective towards their own, towards their own society. And, you know, like, speaking, let's say of Israel, let's say it's becoming so difficult. Like, okay, regardless of the current situation, but even prior that, in order for you to purchase something in Israel, and I may be wrong exactly the concept, I don't know everything top of my head, you have to send money to 3 different parties. You have to send, partial purchase goes to a seller, partial purchase goes to someone who is something like escrow. It's between a notary public and a lawyer, and a partial purchase goes to the government. And then you ask yourself, why the government? Because the government has to collect taxes, but they don't have a fixed tax system. So they're going to keep that money until they figure out how much the seller actually owes them money. So situations like this just push the buyer away because it's becoming too complicated. The good thing is that many of these countries, as I said, offer incentives through these taxes, and it's helpful because it makes you think twice where you should spend your money or your retirement money on, before you say, hey, it's about time for me to stop with work.
Yeah. Well, that is something that is becoming increasingly common, I think, for Americans to start looking abroad in terms of how they can afford to live after they retire. But as you point out, it's a very complicated system, and that really is interesting that you've stepped into that as a information resource and a kind of a Sherpa, I guess, if somebody's going to take a long journey. That's a very important service. Yeah.
That's if I may just, cut you off. We mentioned casinos. We mentioned shopping centers. We mentioned stuff like that. And it's out there that it's 20 cents, 30 cents on a dollar. They need buyers. Mm. And now talking about something like that, it's not limited to just group of people. There could be syndication of us buying something in Europe that can actually be our investment, not just our place to go and live or to potentially putting on Airbnb. But you sit here, you're limited what you have in front of you. Mm-hmm. You're limited what you have in your vicinity. You may eventually change the state, because you still want to go and check it out back and forth. But buying a casino in Cyprus, which is part you know, between Greece and Turkey, and it's an amazing deal. Even if you want it, it was like, you know, damn, how am I going to do that? You know, they have deals, especially after Corona, when, you know, they destroyed the whole market. Yeah. They were abandoned hotels, abandoned shopping centers. That they were, they would love to sell to someone, but the capital is limited in Europe. So this is where we're opening a door, even for commercial real estate. Hey, what do you need? You know, we buy foreclosures, abandoned projects. This is where this major key is, that like a residential buyers, an average Joe can potentially buy because it's cheaper. I hate this word cheaper, more affordable in Europe. In Europe, you can buy, I mean, I'm not even kidding. In Europe, you can buy a hotel in Athens, Greece for $4 million that already is working well and generating you return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that, it's so appealing. I mean, what's $4 million for, you know, people to take a loan, a couple of friends, and buy a hotel? I mean, it's everyone's dream. And then even move there or just rent it out. But you just, how am I going to do that? That's the biggest concept.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It really has been fascinating to kind of get a picture of that. And again, the company is IMMOBILIUM, Immobilium. And that's .io. Yes, thank you so much. Sasha Paparik, thank you so much for joining us and giving us a view of what's happening in the rest of the world as we look at real estate and economies that are happening there. Thank you so much.
It was nice being invited. I love your studio, environment. It looks amazing. I'm a big fan of listening to you, and you're much more pleasant, so to say, almost like in virtual person than like just listening.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Have a good day. Thank you. Well, certainly technology is changing everything. It's changing it at a very quick pace. And I want to get his perspective as somebody who knows the American market, but also knows other markets and has that perspective. We're going to see these institutions that have been around for a very long time. They've outgrown, but the technology has outgrown the way that we actually buy and sell houses. So we're going to see a lot of change in that. But the bottom line is, Klaus Schwab has got it right. You will own nothing as long as you've got property taxes. That's one thing that we need to work on here in America to make sure that we actually can own property, or they will take it from us with that. So I hope you found that interesting. Thank you for joining us. Have a good weekend.
The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.
Career changers, including veterans and active duty service members. Your transition starts here. Go from GI to IT in a matter of months. Become a certified cyber warrior with training at My Computer Career. Cybersecurity specialists are in high demand, offering IT pros great opportunities and a rewarding lifestyle while protecting our people, liberty, and treasured institutions from cyber threats. Deploy your career in IT today at mycomputercareer.edu/CWP, an elite CompTIA certification partner.
VA education benefits are available to those who qualify.